Well, we really have to take a step back and realize that the way that we're raising animals is putting us at risk for even greater threats down the road. You know, when we overcrowd thousands of animals in these cramped, filthy football field-sized sheds to, you know, like beak to beak or snout to snout atop their own waist, it's just a breeding ground for disease. The sheer numbers of animals, the overcrowding, the stress crippling their immune systems, the ammonia from the decomposing waste burning their lungs, lack of fresh air, lack of sunlight. Put all these factors together, what you have is really a perfect storm environment for the emergence and spread of these so-called super strains of influenza. Yeah, I mean, the bottom line, it's not worth risking the lives of millions of people for the sake of cheaper chicken.
Was Dr. Michael Greger himself, and this is another episode of Follow Your Kind, and I'm your host, Christina. So yes, you're not mistaken, the Michael Greger from thenutritionfacts.org is the person who I am interviewing today. And today, out of all days, also marks the day when Dr. Greger's new book, How to Survive a Pandemic, comes out as a physical copy. It comes out as a paperback. So it's a very special day, and I'm just so incredibly lucky to be able to be having this conversation with Dr. Greger. So I don't know about you, but to me, it was certainly a surprise to find out that Dr. Greger, again, the nutrition facts that Dr. Greger, how not to die, Dr. Greger, how not to diet, Dr. Greger, the nutrition expert, is also the person who spent half of his career before going into nutrition, researching and writing books about infectious disease. So it wasn't until a few months ago when the Audible version of his book, How to Survive a Pandemic, came out that I realized the just level of expertise that he had in that field as well. And then, of course, his book does an amazing job highlighting and connecting the two issues that we have today, the diet and then the development, the emergence and the development of the pandemics, be it COVID-19 or the pandemics that took place historically. So this is a great and very exciting conversation, at least it was for me. I asked Dr. Greger about how he actually made a jump from the infectious diseases to the nutrition. We talk about how did we get here in terms of the pandemic development and how food agriculture contributed to it. We talk about how our sad American diet contributes to the poor outcomes that we've been having during the pandemic, the mortality rates. And then, of course, we further then transition into the solution. So what does it look like going forward from here on the individual level, on the society level? What can we do to protect ourselves, our families, and to not only help to stop the spread of the current pandemic, but also potentially prevent the future pandemics that may come out if we don't change the way that we do things. I really, really hope you enjoy this conversation. Again, I'm so incredibly excited and grateful to be talking to Dr. Greger on the day that his book comes out. I hope that you give it a chance. Go check it out. It's available on Amazon, all your local booksellers. The audiobook is available on Audible, and Dr. Greger is the one who reads it with his amazing intonations, which are always just so effective and entertaining. So I hope you enjoy the interview, and I hope you all are doing amazing and taking care of yourselves during this crazy but also wildly amazing time. Okay, and we are on. And today is a very, very special episode of Follow Your Kind podcast. Today we have one and only amazing Dr. Michael Greger himself on the very day that the paperback of his new book, How to Survive Pandemic, is coming out. Welcome to the show, Dr. Greger.
I am honored to be here. How are you doing today?
Well, now my whole day just transformed into being one of the most amazing days of this year. So I very much appreciate hearing your voice on this recording. How are you?
I'm doing great. Let's jump right in.
That sounds perfect. So I know that you do not need an introduction as the field expert in the field of nutrition and a go-to with your nutritionfacts.org website and a number of books that you released. But for me personally, it has been a surprise until just a few months ago that you are also a professional and a subject matter expert in the area of emerging infectious diseases. And in fact, almost half of your career, I believe, was spent researching and writing books about that area. Could you talk a little bit about that time during your career, and then how did you make a jump towards nutrition?
Yeah, no one was listening back then. You know, public health experts have been shouting from the rooftops for decades about the threat of the coming pandemic. I wrote a prior book about pandemic prevention and preparedness, and nobody was listening. And so, but finally, I think COVID-19 is the kind of fire drill we needed to wake us from our complacency to reform the food system before it's too late. So I switched over to chronic disease, the number one killer every single year from 1919 to 2019, but always knowing in the back of my mind that a year earlier in 1918, the number one killer wasn't heart disease. For the only time in the last century, it was pandemic flu, and another pandemic was just a matter of time.
That is so helpful, and I remember listening to another interview of yours, and you saying that yes, the heart disease being the number one killer of Americans has only been for 100 years, but if we look just 1 year past, we would have seen what we were looking for, but nobody supposedly was expecting. So now transitioning into the content of your book and how diet relates to pandemic, how did we get here?
Well, you know, over the last few decades, hundreds of human pathogens have emerged at a rate unprecedented in human history. So wait a second, emerged from where? Mostly from animals. The AIDS virus is blamed on the butchering of primates and the bushmeat trade in Africa. Mad cow disease was because we turned cows into carnivores and cannibals. SARS and COVID-19 have been traced back to the exotic wild animal trade. But our last pandemic, swine flu in 2009, arose not from some backwater wet market in Asia, but was largely made in the USA on industrial pig operations in the United States. Thankfully, swine flu only killed about 500,000 people, but the next time, we might not be so lucky.
I don't know if many people are realizing how much of the factor that our food agriculture and the way that we produce food in this country, what an impact it has on and had in the past on each of the pandemics that we have historically have seen.
You know, look, as devastating as COVID-19 has been, it may just be a dress rehearsal for an even greater threat waiting in the wings of chickens. According to the CDC, the leading candidate for the next pandemic virus after COVID-19 is a bird flu virus known as H7N9, which is 100 times deadlier than COVID-19. Instead of 1 in 250 people dying, H7N9 has killed 40% of the people it infects. The last time a bird flu virus jumped directly to humans and caused a pandemic, it triggered the deadliest plague in history, the 1918 pandemic, which killed 50 million people. That was a 2% death rate. I mean, what if we had a pandemic infecting billions where death was closer to a flip of a coin? But the good news is there's something we can do about it. Just as eliminating the exotic animal trade and live animal markets may go a long way towards preventing the next coronavirus pandemic, reforming the way we raise domestic animals for food may help forestall the next killer flu.
Mm-hmm. That's great to understand the effect of our food production system and food agriculture on the emergence of such pandemics. But now, can we transition into what is actually our diet doing to our health, and how is that impacting the way that COVID-19 has affected Americans so far, given the death rates and the infection rates? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, consider the underlying risk factors for COVID-19 severity and death. Obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, all of which can be controlled or even reversed with a healthy enough plant-based diet and lifestyle. In fact, and you don't even have to be obese, just being overweight puts you at risk. Those with a body mass index of 28 or more, which is about 175 pounds at the average American height, appears to be put you at nearly six times the odds of suffering a severe COVID-19 course. In the U.S., the average BMI exceeds 29. So even being skinnier than the average American can put you at so much excess body fat to put you at a significantly higher risk. So this is the time to take care of ourselves, to get sufficient sleep, keep active, reduce stress, you know, stay connected, albeit remotely, with friends and family, and start eating a healthy diet, not only to protect you against chronic disease in the future, but against the current infectious disease threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pre-existing condition question is definitely something that has been talked about and is being talked about a lot more recently. And my hope it is that it will be an opening and a window for the lifestyle medicine initiatives really to get some resource and support for that. Could you also speak beyond the pre-existing conditions? What is what are some of the effects on plant-based nutrition or healthy diet overall can have on our immune system? So not just the effects that the virus takes in our body once it's there, but also just our susceptibility to the virus.
Well, you know, there are amazing studies showing that simple foods can boost your immune system, like, you know, randomized double-blind trials showing that eating broccoli sprouts can reduce viral loads for influenza, decrease virus-induced inflammation, and boost our antiviral natural killer cell activity, all from just eating broccoli. But this isn't the flu. Unlike other common viruses, coronaviruses have not been shown to cause a more severe disease in immunosuppressed patients. And you say, wait a second, why? Because your own immune system appears to be the main driver of lung tissue damage during infection. Starting around the second week of symptoms, the virus can trigger what's called a cytokine storm. It's like an autoimmune reaction where your body overreacts, and in attacking coronavirus, your lungs get caught in the crossfire. And, you know, in burning down the village in order to save it, we may not survive the process. So, I mean, I certainly support general common sense advice to stay healthy during the crisis, but I would not go out of your way to take supplements or eat specific foods to boost elements of your immune system until we understand more about this virus.
Interesting. So I'm originally from Ukraine. I've been in the country for 13 years now, but I grew up in Ukraine. And I know that something that my grandmother heavily encouraged us to do every year during the flu season is to eat lots of fresh garlic and lots of fresh onion. Based on the research that you have seen, have you seen any efficacy behind those foods to help with immune health or prevent infectious disease?
Well, if your garlic breath gets so bad that no one comes anywhere near you, well, then absolutely. The whole point, if that will help you social distance, then that would work. However, if you're surrounded by garlic lovers and all they want to do is kiss you when you eat a lot of garlic, well, then it kind of defeats the purpose.
I love that. From here on, now that we find ourselves in the midst of this pandemic and there's not much that we can do in to change where we are now, but how do we move going forward? Can you talk more about how can we move towards solution on both the individual and the society level? What each of us, let's start with individual, what each of us can do starting today in terms of social distancing or dieting or any other modifications to our lifestyle in order to stop further spread of the current pandemic as well as potentially prevent future ones?
Well, the most important thing we can do individually right now to deal with COVID is distance, distance, distance. I mean, you can't get the virus unless the virus can get to you. Unfortunately, this COVID-19 is like the flu and that people can be contagious before showing symptoms. So days after becoming unknowingly infected, you can look perfectly fine, feel perfectly fine, but be exhaling virus with every breath. I mean, that's why these physical distancing measures have been necessary, because without sufficient mass testing, you don't know who's infected. So you have to just try to keep everyone apart from everyone else. And my concern with masks, for example, is that it would give people a false sense of security, and they might find themselves lured into, you know, crowded indoor spaces, confined spaces with poor ventilation, thinking their mask is protecting them, when master better than nothing, but the most important thing is to stay away from people, particularly for any extended period of time indoors.
Okay. What about some other common questions that people sometimes ask about washing their produce, for example, or disinfecting the surfaces? What is the level of effectiveness of those actions?
Well, what we've learned is that so-called fomite transmission, meaning transmission from inanimate objects such as doorknobs and light handles and elevator buttons, does not appear to be a major route of transmission. It appears to be these respiratory droplets. So it's not so. So now, washing your hands is always a good idea after touching a public surface, before touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. But it will protect you against the common cold and regular seasonal influenza. But in terms of COVID-19, the most important thing is, again, these respiratory droplets. So it's just being in confined space with someone else breathing, talking. And so that's really the most important thing we can do. And so we don't have to worry about disinfecting, you know, groceries or takeout, anything that comes into our home. That's not the primary concern. The primary concern is other people breathing in our direction.
Mm-hmm. I know that especially early on, there was a lot of talk about theories if the and how fast the virus is mutating. Have you seen any data on that, or what is your take on the mutation levels and how helpful or unhelpful it is from our perspective for finding a vaccine?
Oh, well, so the virus, it's an RNA virus, so it continues to mutate, but is not mutating in a way that appears to make it any more transmissible or any more pathogenic, any more disease-causing. So it just appears to be kind of random mutation. In terms of how well we'll be able to pin it down with immunity with a vaccine, unfortunately, we probably won't know for many years to come. We may be in a situation where we'd have to get an annual vaccination just like we do with the flu. But hopefully we'll be able to get a little more longstanding immunity. Unfortunately, with the common cold coronaviruses, there are two which just cause mild cold symptoms. Average length of immunity is on the order of 54 weeks. So we're really only talking about a year. But hey, that would be enough to put to really tamp down this pandemic. And so even if we do have to do it on an annual basis, the most important thing is getting a safe, effective vaccine out as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. And if you were given a crystal ball, or maybe you have one, the output that you do, I wouldn't doubt if you may have one already. But if you were given a crystal ball, Dr. Greger, what would your kind of guesses or projections would be in terms of how long will it take for us until we can have concerts and social events? How long will we have to wear masks? How long until the schools can go back in full capacity? And when the vaccine is going to come around?
Well, the only way to stop a pandemic is herd immunity, having a critical portion of the populace immune to the virus. Infection can only burn through a population if there are enough susceptible individuals for the viral sparks to jump from one person to the next. Immune individuals who can't get or transmit the virus act as fire breaks to slow the spread, or like control rods in a nuclear reactor to break the chains of transmission. Now, ideally, this would be accomplished through mass vaccination. Vaccines are the way to fight kind of fire with fire, using the virus to fight the virus by generating the benefits of infection immunity without the risks, disease and death. Now, without a vaccine, herd immunity is only achieved the hard way through mass infection, but hopefully we'll be able to get a workable vaccine before then. I don't expect to have a vaccine available for the general population until the second half of next year. So it's going to be a long time. So nothing's going to change anytime soon. Looking at what's happening in Australia now, it's winter there. They're actually having a very mild flu season. So there was a concern that we would have a seasonal flu on top of the COVID-19 this summer, this winter, and that would, you know, take up hospital beds and make things even worse. But all this, you know, social distancing, all the measures we put in place to stop COVID-19 has also done a great job in helping to stop the seasonal flu virus as well. So I think we should expect a mild flu, but COVID-19 will continue to burn unless we're willing to take the kind of measures that other countries have done and New York City has done, and really, shut down these places where COVID spreads, like bars, indoor dining, choirs, that kind of thing. Ramp up our testing, isolating, tracing, quarantine. Everybody needs to wear a mask, wash your hands, watch the distance. I mean, these kind of common sense measures, but it's hard for people to maintain these measures for the long term. But they must realize, the longer that they that this virus burns, the farther, normalcy is going to be in the future. And so we really each have to do our part to try to slow down this virus as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, as a healthcare professional, it was my first time being in healthcare through the pandemic, as I'm sure some other people may relate. But what I'm curious about, with all of your experience and expertise with infectious disease that you've gained even from before you started on this path of nutrition, and as you said earlier, you were shouting from the rooftops about the upcoming pandemic before, but nobody wanted to listen. And now being able to observe this pandemic and this virus as it makes its way through the society and through the world, what are some of the things that you expected? And then what were some of the things that you've seen that maybe took you by surprise?
The most surprising thing is the complete collapse of a federal response here in the U.S. We've had pandemic planning since back in the Bush administration. But unfortunately, those pandemic plans were not put into place. The CDC was sidelined. And so basically the experts who have been, working on this for 40 years were ignored, and instead it became kind of a political football. And so the countries where that happened, like the U.S. and the U.K., are suffering the consequences of it, whereas other countries that have been able to, put in place the measures that were necessary to slow this virus have successfully clamp down on this virus. So when you hear, there's a second wave in South Korea or Singapore or Australia, they're talking about all of a sudden there were 10 cases, right? So New Zealand just had 100 days with zero cases. And then all of a sudden they had a few cases and they're all upset. They're locking down. Okay, yeah, that's great. But I mean, here we're having a thousand people are dying practically every day. It's just been really sad, the unnecessary death and destruction that has come when we've known how to deal with pandemics. It was just, there's been such a patchwork response because we did not have any strong leadership at the federal level.
Okay. Well, now I want to transition to the brighter side. So let's focus on the solution and what does moving forward look like, maybe on the society level, on the regulation level, revisiting the way that we raise or grow food. Can you talk about some of the things that give you hope or some of the things that you're excited about that are possibilities to help us stop or kind of calm this one down and then prevent the future pandemics?
Well, we really have to take a step back and realize that the way that we're raising animals is putting us at risk for even greater threats down the road. When we overcrowd thousands of animals in these cramped, filthy football field-sized sheds to beak to beak or snout to snout atop their own waste, it's just a breeding ground for disease. The sheer numbers of animals, the overcrowding, the stress crippling their immune systems, the ammonia from the decomposing waste burning their lungs, lack of fresh air, lack of sunlight, put all these factors together, what you have is really a perfect storm environment for the emergence and spread of these so-called super strains of influenza. The bottom line, it's not worth risking the lives of millions of people for the sake of cheaper chicken.
And I also really like the idea that you propose about clean meat and the opportunity that there lies there to refocus our efforts and how the risks are just so much smaller. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. We really do. I mean, that's the solution, is to accelerate the movement towards plant-based milks, plant-based meats, plant-based egg products. A couple of years ago, this may have seemed pie in the sky. But now major U.S. dairies are going out of business because there's a constellation of new choices for consumers. Now you open the dairy case, there's 20 different milks out there, and the same innovations are happening in the meat case. And this is not just niche products. Major meat producers, Tyson, Purdue, Smithfield, Hormel, have already started innovating us out of this precarious situation by making plant-based meat alternatives. Cargill, one of the biggest meat packers in the world, largest corporation, private corporation in America, is rolling out plant-based chicken nuggets for KFC in China. I mean, this is a huge shift. So these major meat companies are basically reorienting themselves into thinking themselves as protein companies, not meat companies. And so if you can make meat without producing animals with lungs, then we don't have to worry about these, you know, brewing up new respiratory viruses. Same thing. Look, we don't have to worry about intestinal bugs, E. coli, salmonella, if you're making meat without making intestines. You don't have to cook the crap out of the meat if there's no crap to begin with, right? And so that's one way. But look, for all those who say, well, look, I don't want a plant-based meat, you know, I have to pry that pork chop out of my cold, dead hands. Well, I've got good news for them, too. We may be able to have our meat and eat it, too. An even more innovative approach to pandemic prevention was suggested by none other than Winston Churchill in 1932, when he predicted that one day we shall escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing. And indeed, we can now grow meat straight from muscle cells, so cultivate meat directly. But again, you're not doing it, so there's no food safety issues because you don't have to worry about intestinal bugs. There's no pandemic risk because you're not worrying about respiratory viruses without lungs. And so people can eat all the meat they want. It's just we have to change the way we're producing it. But there's a way out. In this age of emerging diseases, there are now billions of feathered and curly-tailed test tubes for viruses to incubate and mutate within. You know, billions more spins at pandemic roulette. Look, we may be one bushmeat meal away from the next HIV, one pangolin plate away from the next killer coronavirus, and one factory farm away from the next deadly flu. But along with human culpability comes hope. If changes in human behavior can cause new plagues, well, then changes in human behavior may prevent them in the future.
I love that. I love that. You have such an amazing way to communicate things that are funny, that are just completely easy to digest, but at the same time, profound and memorable. I really, really appreciate your skills as an educator of us. And I'm really, really glad that you're playing on our plant-based side, Dr. Gregor.
I'm on the side of the evidence. I'm on the side of science, wherever the chips may land.
That is true. Another one of my of your favorite expressions of mine that I picked up that is related to the pandemic is that the animals can use some social distancing too.
We need to give the animals a little breathing room. You know, measures as simple as providing straw bedding for pigs have been shown, you know, so they don't have the immunosuppressive stress of living on bare concrete their whole lives, can significantly cut down on swine flu transmission rates. So there certainly are tweaks we can make, reforms in the way we raise animals. But in terms of putting an end to pandemic risk for good, in terms of these highly pathogenic, highly disease-causing influenzas, it's really a matter of, you know, shifting away from animal agriculture altogether.
Right. Dr. Gregor, I know that you have tons of fans and friends all over the world and you travel all the time. And I'm curious if you had a chance to try one of those burgers that didn't have to grow lungs in order to make a piece of burger. Have you had a chance to do that?
I have. I've had both the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger. I was curious to see, and you know, the problem is I haven't eaten meat in so long. It's been 30 years since I've eaten like an animal based burger. Mm-hmm. So when I say tastes the same, I'm not the one to ask. I mean, you have to ask a meat eater who's like, you know, who eats burgers every day, and then to see if the difference, it tasted really meaty to me. But again, you know, I'm just used to eating Brussels sprouts.
What about the cell-based meat? Have you tried any of that yet?
Oh, I haven't. I mean, not that I wouldn't, but I just, you know, I think the price point is so high, it hasn't reached commercialization yet.
Yeah.
You know, like anything, it would be, I mean, it wouldn't be particularly healthy. You know, still got the animal protein. But, you know, it doesn't matter what you eat on your birthdays or holidays or special occasions. So, I may have a, you know, cultivated burger on the, you know, my 50th birthday or something. How about that?
Dr. Greger, what does your treat look like for your birthday?
I eat too healthy. I mean, I eat boringly healthy day in, day out. Although on Thanksgiving, I do the whole, sweet potato marshmallow thing. That's a little scandalous, but it's a special occasion.
I love that. Well, I really appreciate you leading by example, Dr. Greger. I know you every time, the only reason that you're not walking on the treadmill right now, I imagine, is because you're in Hawaii. But every time that I've seen you before, you're walking on your treadmill, you're eating your vegetables. And I just very much appreciate all the amazing work that you do. I have a question that I usually close up the podcast with. But before I ask that, is there anything else, any parting words that you wanted to share before we start wrapping it up?
Encourage people to check out the new book if they're interested. You know, all proceeds I receive from my books are all donated directly to charity. I just want everyone to have access to this, life-saving information.
Absolutely. And I'll make sure to include all the links in the show notes. The book is amazing. It just provides such a good background of previous pandemics, such a good understanding of current, and then what the solution again looks like, and just makes you think differently and gives you a better perspective of what it is that we're walking through. So highly suggest, make sure to check it out. And there's audiobook version with Dr. Greger himself, which is amazing.
Oh my God. That was a long 2 weeks recording that. I tell you, woo.
Okay. So the last question that I usually close with is, the name of the podcast is Follow Your Kind. So my intention is to explore the meaning of kindness, the value of kindness with other people, so that we as listeners can try it on and perhaps follow our own version of kindness. So what does kindness mean to you, Dr. Greger?
Well, kindness right now in the context of pandemic, I think we have to be particularly kind, particularly thinking about our neighbor, our community, our families. You see some of these crazy YouTube videos now of people just going ballistic. I mean, people are just so on edge, right? We just have to bend over backwards. It's like road rage all over the place. We just need to bend over backwards to be particularly kind to people. We have no idea what's going on with people. People are losing loved ones. We just need to, you know, of all the times, it's a good idea anyway, but I tell you, we just have to give people the greatest possible benefit of the doubt and do unto others as we would hope they do unto us.
I love that. Thank you so much, Dr. Greger. And as you were speaking, I was also thinking that wearing a mask is also kind to other people.
Oh, yeah, wear the mask, right. Remember, the mask is protecting others from you, not protecting you from others primarily. And so, right, it's really a sign that you respect others. It's a sign that you respect your community. You don't want to make anyone sick. You want to be part of the solution. So even though they don't work that well, certainly better than nothing, but it's more of kind of a signal that, you care about your fellow human beings.
I love that. Dr. Greger, thank you so, so much for your time. I feel incredibly lucky. I got a whole half an hour with you. I hope you have amazing whatever time of the day you're having right now. and good luck with your book. I'm a big fan, and I'm sure we'll be following you going forward as well.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good work yourself.
Thank you.